happy November and welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I'm recording this on the 1st of November. It is the first podcast I have recorded in November, the double first. I hope you enjoyed your Halloween, the first Halloween in a very long time to fall on a Saturday with a full moon also on the Daylight Savings Day here in the US and Canada. It's a time of many signs and portents, including a little election on our horizon. And if you are entitled to vote in the US election and you care what I think, I'm going to ask you to vote, particularly because I live in the United States, but I am not entitled to vote in the election. And so all I get to do is tell other people how important it is to me that they go out and vote. And it is very important to me that you go out and vote. This is an historic election. There's a lot riding on it. Turnout itself is going to be a dispositive factor in the legitimacy of whatever outcome arises. And so even if you are in a place that you judge to be gerrymandered to the point where your vote doesn't even matter, the total volume does matter. One of the things that's on the ballot is the Americans and American voters' belief that voting matters. And so you can vote for voting by turning out and voting. Voting, voting, voting. And so that is what I advise and ask you to do. I just had a look at a bunch of different voting guides. It looks like Rock the Vote, which is quaintly anachronistic. It's a pretty good place to start. That has good guides nationwide to how to vote wherever you happen to be. Please vote for those of us who can't, including those of us who live outside of the U.S. but who are affected by U.S. policy decisions. That is to say everyone, as well as all of the children yet to come, whose futures will be affected by things like American climate policy, which is another thing that is definitely on the ballot in this race. Please go and vote. Did I mention I want you to vote? All right, when you're done voting, there's some stuff coming up in my life. On the 9th of November, a time by which I'm sure everything will be fine and there will be no stress or anxiety and the vote will be finalized. On the 9th of November, I will be participating in the Lincoln Network's Reboot Conference. I'm doing an interview with Lincoln's CTO and a little sort of two-person panel called How to Fix the Internet. I'm going to be speaking at the Texas Book Festival on November the 12th in a panel called Cyber Terrorists, Post-Apocalyptic Landscapes, and Where Pomeranians? Seriously. And then at the Design Thinkers Conference on November the 16th, I will be on a panel called Let's Talk About Influence. So you can tune in to see me at any of those. Still working on getting the Attack Surface book tour videos in hand, but I'm hoping to have them pretty shortly now that the month has gone by and we're ready to start over again with a new month and a new time. And that is really all the news that's fit to print. If you're following the Attack Surface Kickstarter, you know that I'm down to the last end of the distribution of backer rewards, and the sticking point now is the FLAC files. Those are giant files that are losslessly compressed. Someone asked me during the campaign if I would make them available, and I said, sure, why not, thinking that only a few people would take me up on them and that I could just create a shared Google folder on Google Drive and invite a few people to it. It turns out that thousands of people wanted it, which is not something I anticipated. And so that's a bigger lift because Google Drive does not like you sharing folders with thousands of people. And so I think at this point I'm going to end up going with Sendowl. There's been a vigorous discussion of this on the Kickstarter update page where I asked about it this morning on Sunday. And, you know, based on what everyone has said and based on the amount of technical comfort on the part of the kind of median user, the median customer here, I don't want to go with something like BitTorrent or encrypted files or anything that would require a lot more handholding. And it seems like Sendowl, for all that they charge 20 cents a gig, is worth doing. If you signed up for the FLAC and you get an invite to download it from Kickstarter and you don't want it, you don't have to get it. If you do want it, please go ahead and download it. I'm good spending the 42 cents or whatever it's going to cost to deliver it to you. The Kickstarter did very well. Don't have any hesitance on that part. I'm also nearly done hand copying the manuscripts for the two people who bought the failed last chapter of Little Brother as hand-copied manuscripts. This is the original last chapter that I scrapped and redid to give the book a satisfying ending. So I'm nearly done hand-copying those, and then I'm on to the short story commissions, which should be fun. I'm also really on track with The Lost Cause, the next novel. It is looking like the first draft will be in hand by Christmas or New Year's, you know, assuming that there isn't a horrific civil war or other massive unrest that might get in the way of that. Anyway, without further ado, part 21 of Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town, my 2006 novel that Gene Wolfe called an extraordinary book unlike any other you have ever read. Thank you, Gene, and rest in peace. He went back to school the day after they buried Davy. He bathed all of the brothers in the hot spring and got their teeth brushed, and he fed them a hot breakfast of boiled mushroom and jerky stew, and he gathered up their schoolbooks from the forgotten corners of the winter cave and put them into school bags. Then he led them down the hillside on a spring day that smelled wonderful, loam and cold water coursing down the mountainside in rivulets, and new grass and new growth drying out in a hard white sun that seemed to spring directly overhead 5 minutes after it rose. They held hands as they walked down the hill, and Elliot Frankie George broke away and ran down the hill to the roadside, skipping over the stones and holding their belly as they flew down the hillside. Alan laughed at the impatient jig they danced as they waited for him and Brad to catch up with them, and Brad put an arm around his shoulder and kissed him on the cheek in a moment of uncharacteristic demonstrativeness. He marched right into Mr. Davenport's office with his brothers in tow. "We're back," he said. Mr. Davenport peered at them over the tops of his glasses. "You are you?" "Mom took sick," he said, "very sick. We had to go and live with our aunt, and she was too far away for us to get to school."
"I see," Mr. Davenport said.
"I taught the littler ones as best as I could," Alan said. He liked Mr. Davenport, understood him. He had a job to do and needed everything to be accounted for and filed away. It was okay for Alan and his brothers to miss months of school, provided that they had a good excuse when they came back. Alan could respect that. "And I read ahead in my textbooks. I think we'll be okay."
"I'm sure you will be," Mr. Davenport said. "How is your mother now?"
"She's better," he said. "But she was very sick, in the hospital."
"What was she sick with?"
Alan hadn't thought this far ahead. He knew how to lie to adults, but he was out of practice.
"Cancer," he said, thinking of Marcy's mother.
"Cancer?" Mr. Davenport said, staring hard at him. "But she's better now," Alan said.
"I see. You boys, why don't you get to class? Alan, please wait here a moment."
His brothers filed out of the room and Alan shuffled nervously, looking at the class ring on Mr. Davenport's hairy finger, remembering the time that Davy had kicked him. He'd never asked Alan where Davy was after that, and Alan had never offered, and it had been as though they shared a secret.
"Are you all right, Alan?" he asked, settling down behind his desk, taking off his glasses.
"Yes, sir," Alan said.
"You're getting enough to eat at home. There's a quiet place where you can work."
"Yes," Alan said, squirming. "It's fine now that Mom is home."
"I see," Mr. Davenport said.
"Listen to me, son," he said, putting his hands flat on the desk. "The school district has some resources available. Clothes, lunch vouchers, Big Brother programs. They're not anything to be ashamed of. It's not charity. It's just a little booster. A bit of help. The other children, their parents are well and they live in town and they have lots of advantages that you and your brothers lack. This is just how we level the playing field. You're a very bright lad and your brothers are growing up well. And it's no sin to accept a little help."
Alan suddenly felt like laughing. "We're not underprivileged," he said, thinking of the mountain, of the feeling of being encompassed by the love of his father, of the flakes of soft, lustrous gold the golems produced by the handful. "We're very well off," he said, thinking of home, now free of Davy and his hateful, spiteful anger. "Thank you, though," he said, thinking of his life unfolding before him, free from the terror of Davy's bites and spying and rocks thrown from afar.
Mr. Davenport scowled and stared hard at him. Alan met his stare and smiled. "It's time for class," he said. "Can I go?"
"Go," Mr. Davenport said. He shook his head.
"But remember, you can always come here if you have anything you want to talk to me about."
I'll remember, Alan said. 6 years later, Bradley was big and strong, and he was the star goalie of all the hockey teams in town, in front of the puck before it arrived, making desperate, almost nonchalant saves that had them howling in the stands, stomping their feet and sloshing their Tim Hortons coffee over the bleachers to freeze into brown ice. In the summer, he was the star pitcher on every softball team, and the girls trailed after him like a long comet tail after the games when the other players led him away to a park to drink illicit beers. Alan watched his games from afar, with his schoolbooks on his lap and Eric, Franz, Greg nearby playing trucks or reading or gnawing on a sucker. By the ninth inning or the final period, the young ones would be too tired to play, and they'd come and lean heavily against Alan, like a bag of lead pressing on him, eyes half open, and Alan would put an arm around them and feel at one with the universe. It snowed on the afternoon of the season opener for the town softball league that year. Fat white flakes that kissed your cheeks and melted away in an instant, so soft that you weren't sure that they'd been there at all. Bradley caught up with Alan on their lunch break at the cafeteria in the high school, two blocks from the elementary school. He had his mitt with him and a huge grin. "You planning on playing through the snow?" Alan said, as he set down his cheeseburger and stared out the window at the diffuse white radiance of the April noontime bouncing off the flakes. "It'll be gone by tonight. Gonna be warm," Bradley said, and nodded at his jock buddies sitting at their long table, sucking down Cokes and staring at the girls. "Gonna be a good game. I know it." Bradley knew. He knew when they were getting shorted at the Assayers, when they brought in the Golem's Gold, just as he knew that showing up for lunch with a brown bag of dried squirrel jerky and mushrooms and lemongrass was a surefire way to end up social roadkill in the high school hierarchy, as was dressing like someone who'd been caught in an explosion at the Salvation Army. And so he had money, and he had burgers, and he had a pair of narrow-leg jeans from the Gap, and a Roots sweatshirt, and a Stussy baseball hat, and Reebok sneakers, and he looked, basically, like a real person. Alan couldn't say the same for himself, but he'd been making an effort since Bradley got to high school, if only to save his brother the embarrassment of being related to the biggest reject in the building. But Alan still managed to exude his don't fuck with me aura enough that no one tried to cozy up to him and make friends with him and scrutinize his persona close in, which was just as he wanted it. Bradley watched a girl walk past, a cute thing with red hair and freckles and a skinny, raw-boned look, and Alan remembered that she'd been sitting next to him in class for going on 2 years, and he'd never bothered to learn her name. And he'd never bothered to notice that she was a dead ringer for Marcy. "I've always had a thing for redheads," Bradley said. "Because of you," he said. "You and your girlfriend, I mean. If she was good enough for you, well, she had to be the epitome of sophistication and sexiness. Back then, you were like a god to me, so she was like a goddess. I imprinted on her like those baby ducks in bio. It's amazing how much of who I am today I can trace back to those days. Who knew it was all so important?" He was a smart kid, introspective without being moody, integrated, always popping off these fine little observations between his easy jokes. The girls adored him, the boys admired him, the teachers were grateful for him, and the way he bridged the gap between scholarship and athleticism. "I must have been a weird kid," he said. "All that quiet." "You were a great kid," Alan said. "It was a lot of fun back then, mostly." "Mostly," he said. They both stared at the girl, who noticed them now and blushed and looked confused. Bradley looked away, but Alvin held his gaze on her, and she whispered to a friend who looked at him, and they both laughed, and then Alan looked away too, sorry that he'd inadvertently interacted with his fellow students. He was supposed to watch, not participate. "He was real," Bradley said, and Alan knew he meant Davy. "Yeah," Alan said. "I don't think the little ones really remember him. He's more like a bad dream to them, but he was real, wasn't he?" "Yeah," Alan said, "but he's gone now." "Was it right?" What do you mean? Alan said. He felt a sear of anger arc along his spine. It's nothing, Billy said, mumbling into his tray. What do you mean, Brad? Alan said. What else should we have done? How can you have any doubts? I don't, Brad said. It's okay. Alan looked down at his hands, which appeared to belong to someone else. White lumps of dough clenched into hard fists, knuckles white. He made himself unclench them. No, it's not okay. Tell me about this. You remember what he was like, what he did?
I remember it, Brian said. Of course I remember it.
He was staring through the table now, the look he got when he was contemplating a future the rest of them couldn't see. But Alan waited. He was trembling inside. He'd done the right thing. He'd saved his family. He knew that. But for 6 years, he'd found himself turning in his memory the little boy on the ground, holding the loops of intestine in through slippery red fingers. For 6 years, whenever he'd been somewhere quiet long enough that his own inner voices fell still, he'd remember the hair in his fist, the knife's thirsty draft, as it drew forth the hot splash of blood from Davy's throat. He'd remembered the ragged fissure that opened down Clarence's length and the way that Davy fell down in it, so light and desiccated that he was almost weightless. If you remember it, then you know I did the right thing. I did the only thing.
We did the only thing, Brian said, and covered Alan's hand with his.
Alan nodded and stared at his cheeseburger. You better go catch up with your friends, he said.
I love you, Adam, he said.
I love you too. Billy crossed the room, nodding to the people who greeted him from every table, geeks and jocks and band and all the meaningless tribes of the high school universe. The cute redhead sprinkled a wiggle finger wave at him, and he nodded at her, the tips of his ears going pink. The snow stopped by 3 p.m., and the sun came out and melted it away so that by the time the game started at 5:30, its only remnant was the soggy ground around the bleachers with the new grass growing out of the ragged brown memory of last summer's lawn. Alan took the little ones for dinner at the diner after school, letting them order double chocolate chip pancakes. At 13, they'd settled into a fatness that made him think of a foam rubber toy, the rolls and dimples at their wrists and elbows and knees like the seams on a doll.
You're starting high school next year, Alan said as they were pouring syrup on their second helping. He was startled by this. How had they gotten so old so quickly?
Yeah, Ellie said, I guess.
So you're graduating from elementary school this spring?
Yeah, Ellie grinned a chocolate smile at him. It's no big deal. There's a party, though.
Where?
At some kid's house.
It's okay, Alan said. We can celebrate at home. Don't let them get to you.
We can't go? Ed suddenly looked a little panicked.
You're invited? He blurted it out and then wished he hadn't.
Of course we're invited, Fred said from inside Ed's throat. There's going to be dancing.
You can dance? Alan asked.
We can, Ed said. We learned in gym, Greg said, with the softest, proudest voice deep within them.
Well, Alan said, he didn't know what to say. High school, dancing, invited to parties. No one had invited him to parties when he'd graduated from elementary school, and he'd been too busy with the little ones to go in any event. He felt a little jealous, but mostly proud.
Want a milkshake? He asked, mentally totting up the cash in his pocket and thinking that he should probably send Brad to dicker with the assayer again soon.
No, thank you, Ed said. We're watching our weight.
Alan laughed, and then he saw they weren't joking and tried to turn it into a cough, but it was too late. Their shy chocolate smile turned into a rubber-lipped pout.
All right, then. Well, that's it for this week. Please do go and vote if you can. Hang in there. If it's any comfort, everyone's freaked out right now. Everyone I've spoken to and me too. And so you're not alone, and neither are any of the rest of us. Talk to you next Sunday.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike, US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, This song is copyrighted in the U.S. under seal of copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, Ryneck Studio at gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.